You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 268, Exodus 7, 14 through 25. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland. He's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. All right, Mike, he is risen.
He is risen indeed. It's Easter.
It is.
Really, I mean, that pretty much summarizes it, which is why, you know, which is why it's so ancient. You know, he is risen indeed, you know, everywhere you go, even across traditions, that is translatable pretty directly. Everybody knows what you're talking about, at least within the Christian tradition. So did you do anything special for Easter? Anything at home or anything like that?
No, not really. I mean, other than going to the church service this weekend, but, you know, nothing, you know, we're not very traditionalist, so I don't even know if we even had hide eggs, you know, I don't know. We just don't take anything serious as far as commercial things like that. I mean, it's not that I'm against it's just, what about y'all?
Yeah, the whole commercialization and, you know, somewhat paganization of it. Right. Yeah.
I mean, people really get up in arms about that. I mean, they really get upset about it if you do the whole egg thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, the fertility symbols and all that. But I mean, that kind of thing would have been theologically meaningful a long, long, long time ago. And, it's all sort of been lost, at least today. I mean, my kids, of course, are older, so we don't even have that on the radar. So, but we just usually get together for dinner. You know, we do the Good Friday service, and then, of course, you know, Easter Sunday. And then, you know, it's a time for everybody to get together, which is kind of nice. So, I mean, other than Molly in North Carolina, everybody's here. So it was nice.
I hear you, Mike. Well, did you see the news about Notre Dame, the fire this week?
Yeah. You know, it's hard not to see that as emblematic, you know, of the whole, not just the situation in France. I mean, France has a serious problem with militant secularism. I mean, they have an Islamization problem, but, you know, even the Muslims, to a lesser extent, are in the crosshairs of these militant secularists, and that, you know, they use French history, you know, to sort of justify that, because, you know, Notre Dame was secularized back in the days of the French Revolution and then reconsecrated later. But, you know, man, I guess at some point, you know, I'll end up going to Paris for some reason, but it's not on my list of places to go. It feels like an outer, you know, one of Dante's outer rings of, you know, hell. It really does. You know,
it's one of the rings. Wow. Okay.
I'd put it there. You know, when I think of France, you know, I just think of, that's a tough place to be a believer. I just admire people who it's historically, it's the seedbed of a lot of European occultism, you know, the whole Jesus bloodline mythology, you know, flakery. And then you've got the militant secularism. You've got Europe, not just France, but destroying itself, you know, through immigration, you know, just open door immigration, not vetting anybody. I mean, it just, boy, you know, I can think of lots of places I'd rather visit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to see this burn, it's like, like I said, it's just hard to not see it as some sort of metaphor. But the believers over there, you know, they are to be admired. They're sticking with it. I mean, I know some, and you know, pray for the church in France. I mean, it's just a dark place. It really is.
We.
Yeah. There you can throw that in. We.
Yeah. Well, speaking of destroying themselves, we've got plagues coming up, Mike.
That's a nice segue there.
You like that? You like that? Yeah. Hey, is there any significance to the number of plagues? There's 10 of them. I was just curious if there's any significance to that.
You know, I've not specifically run across anything, you know, that assigns any meaning to the number, but, yeah, you know, who knows? I may at some point, but to date, no, I haven't come across anything. Well, in case anybody's wondering, you know, that our episode today is going to be Yeah, we're going to hit the first plague because that's in the rest of Exodus 7. But what I wanted to do today was sort of provide an introduction to the plagues, you know, kind of like how do scholars think about these things, and then take some of that in terms of the approaches and then talk about the first plague.
Well, I'm hoping that you're going to give us a clue as to what the blood type was that God turned the water to. I'm curious if it's O negative, because we've covered O negative.
I was going to say, you want me to say it's O negative with RH?
Some ancient document somewhere they knew about blood types, and it's O negative.
For those of you who aren't privy to the joke, go over to peeranormal.com and look for the episode on RH negative blood. Then you'll get it. You'll get the funny. You may even chuckle at that point. But yeah, boy, you're in rare form today, Trey.
Hey, that's well, yeah.
All right. Well, like I said, we are going to have an introduction to the plagues here, and that's how I'll start. And then, you know, we'll get into the first plague and how, again, some of the perspectives on the plagues, how that sort of helps us, you know, think about the first one that's in Exodus 7. And we'll do the same thing as we go through the rest of the plagues too. But since we're at Exodus 7, 14 through 25, let me just read that, and then we'll jump into you know, how scholars approach the whole subject of the plagues. So beginning in verse 14, "Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water. Stand on the bank of the Nile to meet him, and take in your hand the staff that turned into a serpent. And you shall say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But so far you have not obeyed. Thus says the Lord, By this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, with the staff that is in my hand I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and it shall turn into blood. The fish in the Nile shall die, and the Nile will stink, and the Egyptians will grow weary of drinking water from the Nile. And the Lord said to Moses, Say to Aaron, Take your staff, and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, their canals, and their ponds, and all their pools of water, so that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, even in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded. In the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, he lifted up the staff and struck the water in the Nile. And all the water in the Nile turned into blood, and the fish in the Nile died, and the Nile stank, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. There was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts, so Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not take even this to heart. And all the Egyptians dug along the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. 7 full days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile." So the chapter ends with, you know, the plague on the Nile, and then we get, you know, a seven-day interval until we get to the next plague, and we'll hit that next time. But this is one of the plagues, and the majority, you know, are focused specifically on the Egyptians and not on the Hebrews. You'll notice as we read that there's no reference that the Hebrews had this problem as well. That's not going to be true with every plague, but again, for the majority, it is. But rather than, you know, sort of focus on the minutiae, and we'll come back again to some of the details here in the first plague, I want to start here by talking about how scholars approach the whole topic. And I'm going to be referencing, for the most part, John Currid's book, and I alluded to this in our very first episode, and I think a couple of times in other episodes, but he has written a book called Ancient Egypt and the Old Testament. It's Baker Books. It's not an expensive book. Currid is trained in Egyptology and in Old Testament, so this is a good source for thinking about things in Exodus and also about Egyptian material that occurs in other books. So Currid has a whole section on approaches to the plagues. You know, it's over 15 pages long, so he devotes a good bit of attention to it. And he says, the way he breaks things down, I mean, and, you know, we'll just go with it because he's talking about who thinks about the plagues in what way the most. Okay, so he breaks there are 4 views down. He breaks the 4 views down into 2 and 2. So there are 4 basic approaches to how we might understand the plagues, and the 2 most held, what Currid would call the major positions, we'll start with. So the first one is that the plagues are natural disasters. This is probably among just scholars in general, whether they're evangelical or not. This is probably the majority view. So Currid writes in regard to this, in general, this interpretation, again, this that the plagues are natural disasters, attempts to explain the plagues of Egypt as typical natural phenomena of antiquity. Various scholars have tried to prove through textual evidence that similar plagues occurred frequently in the ancient Near East. And Currid has a footnote there that I'm going to get to in a moment, but I'll just continue with his quote. He writes, that such events occur even today in Egypt has been used to argue for the historicity of the plagues. In addition, this position holds that the order of the plagues was naturally progressive. That is, each plague was a cause or a catalyst of the subsequent plague. They built upon one another. So that's the end of that quotation. And in a footnote, if you're interested in sort of other material as far as the plagues being natural phenomenon, he provides a couple of sources, and I'll just give them to you here. Stieglitz's article, and this is an older article, but it's kind of a standard reference point in Biblical Archaeology Review, Volume 13. This was 1987. He wrote an article called Ancient Records and the Exodus Plagues. For a good summary of this view, you could consult Hoffmeyer's article in Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary, just as his entry on plagues in Egypt, and I will be referencing that a bit in this episode. Nahum Sarna, in his book Exploring Exodus, The Heritage of Biblical Israel, has, again, good summaries of this. And David Livingstone, The Plagues and the Exodus. That's in a journal that's fairly obscure to find, Archaeology and Biblical Research, Volume 4, 1991. Now, that one you can find online if you just Google that. So Google Livingstone and then Plagues and Exodus, and you will find a link to that particular article, which is good because that journal's, I don't even think it's published anymore, but again, there you have a good summary. Now, this view, not surprisingly, has a long history. It goes well back into the 19th century, and it kind of gained traction due to the influence of Flinders Petrie, who was a very famous Syro-Palestinian archaeologist, also a very famous Egyptologist. And Currid has a nice summary of sort of Petrie's influence here, and I'll read that. Flinders Petrie popularized the position, and with the publication of his Egypt and Israel, and that was a book, it became the dominant understanding of the plagues. Petrie took the issue a step further by claiming that the plagues were not only a natural sequence, but also the consequences of seasonal changes. In particular, they followed the cycle of the inundation of the Nile River. And at this point, Currid is going to quote from Petrie, and I'll read you Petrie here. The river turned to blood with the fish dying. Was the unwholesome stagnant Nile just at the lowest before the inundation, when it is red and swarming with organisms? The Egyptians have to resort to wells and cisterns at this time in the early part of June. Okay, now let me just stop there. This is Petrie writing, and you'll notice at the end of Exodus 7, there was this reference that the Egyptians had to dig along the Nile for water to drink. And you would think, well, wouldn't that be blood too? Because it was blood even in the jugs and the jars and stuff like that. Again, the narrative, the Exodus narrative actually doesn't say whether their digging for water along the Nile was successful or not. But it's interesting that Petrie picks up on this, and he observed the same thing happening in Egypt while he was there on one of his many campaigns during the low point of the Nile, when it turns, you know, red because of the soil, then it's you can't drink it. So he, back to Petrie's quote, the Egyptians have to resort to wells and cisterns at this time in the early part of June. The frogs abound after the inundation has come in July. The plagues of insects, murrain, and boils belong to the hot summer and damp, unwholesome autumn. The hail and rain came in January. This is closely fixed by the effect on the crops. The barley must have been up early for the wheat to be yet hidden or hardly sprouting. This would show that it was planted early in November, in ear by the middle of January, and ripe early in March. The flax has like seasons, similar seasons, and the wheat is a month later. The locusts come in the spring over the green crops about February. The sandstorms bring a thick darkness that may be felt in March at the break of the hot winds. And the last plague, the death of the firstborn, was at the Exodus in April. The intervals are about a month apart, from the middle of January to mid-April. The time agrees to the months. So that's from Flinders' Egypt and Israel, which was published in 1911. You notice how he didn't really explain the last plague, and that's going to become an issue. But Currid adds at the end of that quotation, according to Petrie's calculations, then the plagues upon Egypt were natural events occurring in less than a 12-month period. So again, that view, published in 1911, sort of became the dominant view in scholarship. And you can see where it appears to have some coherence to it, some alignment at least. Again, it has weaknesses, but that quotation from Petrie doesn't really betray them. We'll get to that in a moment. But you can see how this would sound sort of reasonable, okay? Now, the most recent scholarly defense of this view, though, is that of Greta Hort. And this comes from an article that she published in 1957 called The Plagues of Egypt. It's in the journal abbreviated ZAW, the Zeitschrift für Alttestamentliche Wissenschaft. Just put ZAW and you'll probably find it. I don't know if this is going to be available online. Probably isn't. But a summary of her work you would actually find in Hoffmeyer's Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary essay. So if that's a tool, a resource that any reasonable library, any good reference library that includes religion, is going to have that reference source. So you can read it there too, or at least a summary of it. Now, Currid summarizes Greta Hort's work as well. So let me read you his couple paragraphs there. He writes, according to her study, the first six plagues clearly reflected the ecosystem of ancient Egypt. Okay, let me just stop there. So she's already sounding like Petrie, but notice that she groups things in the first six plagues. Her comments here are the first six. Okay, just hold that thought. So back to Currid, his summary. The first plague was the result of a high inundation that made the river red with sediment, causing it to look like blood. Concurrent excessive precipitation brought flagellates and their bacteria from mountain lakes and streams, resulting in animal death in the river. The death of the fish polluted the water habitat, a disaster which forced the frogs from the river onto dry land. The frogs then died, and soon thereafter mosquitoes, or lice, and flies multiplied off the dead amphibians. The insects in turn carried disease, probably anthrax, to the land animals and eventually to humans. Plagues 7 through 9 were not related sequentially, but they had in common their origination in the atmosphere. Again, whatever that means, this is Currid's wording. Hort emphasized the naturalistic character of these plagues, detailing frequent similar occurrences in Egypt. The final plague may have been merely a reflection of the high infant mortality rate of ancient Egypt. That's the end of Currid's summary of Hort's view. Again, you can see she's right in the tradition of Petrie, maybe a bit more nuanced in the discussion. Again, this is the dominant view in scholarship, just general scholarship. And not surprisingly, this is the view that is held, this view is mostly held by those who would deny any supernatural causation to the plagues. Though that isn't a truism. I mean, there you will find evangelicals who find coherence in this to some extent, but they won't go the full nine yards and just rule out the supernatural for maybe a couple of them, or they'll weave the supernatural somewhere into the narrative, and then use the use sort of the natural phenomenon that has been witnessed in Egypt as an explanation. So they'll get God in there somewhere, but they don't view the plagues as having sort of a direct divine causation. Maybe death of the firstborn or something like that. There'll be some allowance somewhere. Now, Currid notes again about this whole sort of, who's in what camp. He writes this. He says, those scholars who hold that the plagues were natural disasters are generally of two camps. Some believe that the fact that the plagues can be explained as natural phenomena actually serves as confirmation of the supernatural. There are some of those. In other words, if the biblical material detailing the natural phenomena is true, then it follows the entire narrative, including the supernatural elements, is accurate. Let me just stop there. So Kurt is saying, some would say, well, look, if the writer got this right, you know, observing natural phenomena, then, you know, we have to take him at his word as well when it comes to the supernatural causation. So, you know, some are going to try to put God in the narrative that way. Back to Kurd, he writes, most interpreters, however, argue that the commonplace occurrence of phenomena akin to the plagues of Egypt actually explains away the miraculous. The divine or theological elements in the text are merely the author's attempt to dress up a simple naturalistic account. Present-day scholars overwhelmingly adhere to the latter position, which, you know, I just had noted. Now, on the surface, again, you can look at this, and what Petrie says and what Hort says kind of works, at least for the first six, kind of works reasonably well. But the need for a sequential break for plagues, you know, 7 through 9, is in my view kind of telling. I mean, that exposes a real weakness here. And the death of the firstborn hardly seems explainable by natural disaster or just the general infant mortality rate. The language is just far more specific than that. And I guess to Kurd's credit, he's less generous than the way I just summarized that. So I'll just, so that you can get a feel for how Kurd thinks about this. He writes, the interpretation of the plagues as natural disasters has obvious weaknesses and breaks down under careful scrutiny. First of all, nowhere in the 6 chapters detailing the plagues is there any hint of one plague's having been the source of another plague. Okay, that's important. Only by mere speculation can one argue from the text that the frogs were infected with anthrax. Okay, that's a little shot at Hort. And Kurd adds, and you know, only by mere speculation can you argue that the disease was passed on to land animals by lice. And it doesn't say, the text doesn't say that. Second, Kurd observes, the ecological sequence crumbles after the 6th plague because the hailstones of the 7th plague had no relation to the anthrax of plague 6. In addition, plagues 7 through 9 had no chronological connection with one another, even though there was a conceptual relationship. And the 10th plague had absolutely no link with the previous plagues. Finally, the argument that plagues 1 and 10 were simply natural phenomena is difficult to defend. The theory that the first plague was symbolic, the water did not turn into blood but merely look like it, cannot be supported by the text. In no way does the book of Exodus present that plague as having been metaphorical in nature. Rather, it relates the disaster as direct historical narrative. So that's, you know, a summary of, and I would agree with, you know, Kurd, his criticisms there. So the natural disaster view, which again is the dominant view, that has the veneer of coherence. It has the veneer of, you know, reasonableness that it covers the necessary ground, but it actually doesn't when you sort of probe it a little bit. Now, the second major view or the major approach to the plagues is what, you know, Kurd and others would call the literary creations view. And again, just to summarize it, this is a little, in terms of its history, it's a little more recent than the natural phenomenon view. You can trace this to the early 20th century. Kurd, he does note that this one seems to be getting more and more support as time goes on. The basic idea is that behind each plague is a kernel of history that was dressed up in the telling of the story. In other words, we have mythic history here, but mythic history not being, you know, real history. Again, if you're confused by that terminology, you need to go back to the very first episode that we did introducing the book of Exodus, and I talked about mythic history. I think mythic history is history, and there are a number of reasons why I think it's methodologically flawed to impose our modern sense of history and what we think history requires on ancient texts. You know, and then turn out, we hit the end of that road and say, well, the ancient stuff isn't real history. Well, we can't apply the tools of modern historical validation to our own lives. I couldn't write my own biography and meet the criteria of, you know, modern history. And that, again, just a simple observation like that, you know, tells me that maybe we're just not approaching this the right way, you know, because I do know my story. I was there. Okay, I'm an eyewitness, but nevertheless, I can't meet the criteria, and neither can any of you. to tell my story or your own story. So I think, you know, we need to rethink, you know, what we're asking for there. But anyway, back to the literary creations view. Basically, the literary creations view is saying, well, there's something that happened here, and then the writer of Exodus is sort of putting a theological spin on it. So scholars who hold this view believe the text, they're on a spectrum here. They're going to believe something is historical in there. They're going to believe something is ahistorical or fabricated in there. It's going to be a mixed bag. So they're going to deny the historicity in some respects, and they're going to try to affirm it in others. Their approach is a literary approach. They're looking at what the author is doing with sort of boots on the ground events, and then trying to sort of judge the result of that literary production as, well, there's something that went on here, but it's theological spin, and chances are good that some of it's basically on target, you know, that hasn't been spun up too much. But then there's going to be other things that are just, yeah, you know, he just sort of went off the deep end on his description of this or that. So it's going to be a mixed bag here. Now, there are two other views, and I'll telegraph where I'm at. I like both of these views. I think they work well in tandem together. But we'll take them one at a time. The two other views are, if you're numbering this, number three, the polemic view, P-O-L-E-M-I-C, the polemic view. And this is the idea that the 10 plagues were directed against specific Egyptian deities. If you want a little bit more source material here, you could get Charles Ayling's book, Egypt and Bible History. It's 1981. It's an older book. But again, Chuck has a lot of Egyptological training, so it's worthwhile. J.J. Davis, Moses and the Gods of Egypt. That's also old, 1986, but again, still worthwhile. And G.A.F. Knight, Theology as Narration. I'm not familiar with that book. I'm familiar with the other two, but that's an Erdman's title. It's even older, 1976. So those would be three sort of starting points if you're interested in, you know, pursuing this perspective. But Currid comments on this view. Again, this is the polemic view. And he writes this. He says, there should be no question that the biblical authors understood the plagues in that manner. In other words, as a polemic. The book of Numbers, for example, reports, quote, the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn whom the Lord had struck down among them. The Lord had also executed judgments on their gods, unquote. That's Numbers 33, verse 4. In fact, the plague account itself contains similar wording. Quote, for I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord, unquote. That's Exodus 12:12. So Currid says the idea that the disasters that Egypt experienced were a mockery of that land and its customs is unmistakable. The scriptures even use the term mockery. That's the Hebrew term alal for God's judgment upon Egypt. That's in Exodus 10, verse 2. So that's, again, in the narrative portion about the plagues. So, again, the polemic view is that plagues are what they are, specifically because they have something to do with judging the gods of Egypt. Now, I'm not going to go into the details at this point. When I'm done summarizing the approaches of the plagues, we're going to hit the first plague, and then I'll apply some of this. And I can, again, I'll just telegraph where I'm headed here. There are polemic elements, you know, in the first plague, and I'll talk about those in a moment. But there are also elements, or at least I think the fourth approach, you know, helps us to get a good flavor for what's going on in Exodus as well. And the fourth view is that the plagues are examples of decreation. Now, this is also a literary argument, and this one might be unfamiliar to a lot of you in the audience, but I'll use Currid's explanation for this. He has a nice summary of it. He writes, many scholars have pointed out that Exodus 1 through 15, so the first 15 chapters, owes much of its structure, language, and theology to the Genesis creation account. As Warren Gage states, quote, the Exodus history of the Hexateuch, that's the Pentateuch, five books plus, you know, the book following, is so structured as to be a redemptive reenactment of creation, unquote. So let me just stop there. So this view is saying that if you look at Exodus 1 through 15 carefully, there are going to be parts of, you know, that chunk of Exodus that directly hook back into the creation account in Genesis, and the plagues are part of this. But of course, the plagues would not be about creation. It would be about the reversal of creation. Hence, it's called decreation. So Currid writes, in other words, the account of the deliverance of Israel out of the oppression of Egypt through the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea reflects the narrative of the original creation. Although the creation theme is reflected in many passages of Exodus, we will take time to consider only three of them. You know, and then he goes into his book and he talks about, you know, how this works in three places. So I would say, again, go back to the original episode that began our series on Exodus, and we talk about the relationship of Exodus to Genesis, and that'll give you a little bit of flavor for, you know, what we're talking about here. But specifically, again, we'll focus in on the plagues. There are things about the plagues that the way they're described, and even the order and the structure, you know, and so on and so forth, that sort of mimes creation material in Genesis. And so scholars have observed this and thought, why would the author be writing it that way? And so this idea that the plagues are an intentional, not retelling, but detelling of creation, there must be something to that. That must be done for some theological messaging. And again, I think that's a good trajectory. Now, Currid adds a little bit more information by way of examples here. We'll just pick a couple. He writes, the first five verses, for instance, show awareness. This is the first five verses of Exodus, the whole book. Show awareness of the Genesis tradition of the 70 persons descended from the patriarch Jacob. That happens in Genesis 46, 26 through 27. Most importantly, the biblical writer describes the Zitzim Laban, that's the life setting of Israel, in terms of the cultural mandate of Genesis 1:28. Quote, but the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty so that the land was filled with them, unquote. That's Exodus 1:7. And the point is the language there sounds a lot like Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply, you know, fill the earth. So you know, scholars look at that and say, well, okay, the writer obviously knows the wording of Genesis and he's using the wording here to describe something else. So he must be trying to strike a connection. Second example from Currid, the water ordeal Moses underwent is reminiscent of the redemption of Noah in Genesis 6 through 8. After the birth of Moses, his mother Jochebed could not hide him for more than 3 months. So she placed him in a gomeh tevah, that's a wicker basket, Exodus 2:3. The first term, gomeh, is an Egyptian word that means papyrus. Tevah, an Egyptian word which means chest or coffin, is also used in reference to Noah's Ark, believe it or not. It's Noah's Ark is called a Tevah, okay, back in the flood account. One should observe, Currid writes as well, that in Exodus 2:3, Jochebed covers the wicker basket with tar and pitch, just as Noah did the Ark, Genesis 6:14. The deliverance of Noah can be viewed as a recreation because God directs the cultural mandate of Genesis 1:28 to Noah and his offspring. Quote, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That's Genesis 9:1. That command is the same decree that the Hebrews were fulfilling in Exodus 1 as they multiplied and increased in Egypt. So the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt is being cast by the biblical writer as a recreation. And again, when it comes to the plagues, scholars are going to argue that since that sort of takes the land apart or reverses order, that's like a decreation. And again, we'll get to the point of how that might work theologically when we hit the first plague here in a moment. Finally, Currid writes that the Exodus is a second act of creation is evident in Exodus 13 through 15. The Genesis creation account served as the paradigm for Israel's deliverance at the sea. That is to say, the redemptive creation of Israel at the sea is cast in the same narrative style of original creation as the pillar of divine presence brings light into darkness, Exodus 13:21. Of course, that corresponds to the first creation day. And as the waters are divided, in Exodus 14:1, think of Genesis 1:6 there, on the second day, and language on the second day. The dry land emerges, Exodus 14:29. That's what happens on the third creation day. In Deuteronomy 32:11, God's tender care of Israel after she had passed through the sea is likened to an eagle's hovering over and protecting its newborn. The Hebrew term rachaf, hovers, used here in Deuteronomy 32:11 also occurs in Genesis 1:2, where the Spirit of God hovered. It's the same Hebrew verb. And Curd notes, those are the only two occurrences of Rechaf in the Pentateuch. He, of course, is correct there, that the biblical author is drawing a parallel between the original creation account and the Exodus narrative is further confirmed by his use of the Hebrew term tohu. Okay, remember in Genesis 1:2, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And then, you know, now the earth was tohu vabohu, you know, formless and empty, or, you know, however that gets translated. That's Genesis 1:2. Well, that term is used in Deuteronomy 32:10 to describe the wilderness that they're wandering through, you know, in the Exodus narrative. Curd says he also used, again, the author also used the word to characterize the conditions of the original creation. As with Rechaf, tohu also appears nowhere else in the Pentateuch. So that's the end of Curd's treatment there. Now, if you want to get a fuller glimpse of these correspondences, I'm going to send Trey a PDF file, a chart that is drawn from Curd's book, where he, you know, he puts a lot of this stuff in chart form, and you can see, you know, the parallels, and they're actually pretty interesting. So you could take a look at that. So this view, again, the decreation view, has God in effect demolishing creation order in the same manner that he erected creation order back in Genesis. Why would God do this? Well, to the Hebrew reader, again, the Israelite, you know, reading his Bible or her Bible, the point would be telegraphed that I guess we know now who has sovereign control of the order of creation. It's the God of Israel. And they would be able to see the correspondences in their text. So there's a theological point being made. This is also a big deal with Egypt because of the Egyptian concept of Ma'at. That's M-A-A-T. Now, I've mentioned this before, but the Egyptian of Ma'at is sort of the way things are supposed to be because this is the way that the gods created them to be or intended all things to be. It's a cosmic and an earthly and a social order. It's the order of everything. You know, everything is the way the gods intend. And it was Pharaoh's job, you know, as the incarnation of Horus, it was his job to maintain that order. That was a specific task in Egyptian religion. So Pharaoh is supposed to maintain Ma'at as it was bestowed on earth by Ra, and of course, you know, the whole pantheon and all this kind of stuff. So Curd describes Ma'at this way. Let me just read his little summary. Ma'at was a result of the first creation, and this is Egyptian theology, and part of the inherent structure of creation. Ma'at held order together. Ma'at, therefore, was the antithesis of chaos. It was a dynamic force not limited to the initial structure of creation, but always necessary because the veracity of the forces of chaos continued to menace the very existence of the created world. Consequently, the Egyptians strove to maintain Ma'at in their earthly existence. Ma'at was not merely an ideal concept removed from daily living, but the model for human behavior. Humans had to struggle to preserve Ma'at and to keep cosmic balance upon the earth. In ancient Egypt, the king had the duty to maintain Ma'at. He was considered the personification of universal order. Thus, in the instruction for King Meri-Ka-Ra, that's an Egyptian text Curd is referencing here, the pharaoh is advised by his father to, quote, do Ma'at whilst thou endurest upon earth, unquote. Every pharaoh had the obligation to reestablish and reaffirm Ma'at upon accession to the throne. The forces of chaos could upset Ma'at, so at the advent of a new king, order had to be restored. Now, Hofmeyer, in his Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary article, he notes that this was the point of the plagues, just generally. So again, this will telegraph a little bit where Hofmeyer's at. And again, I've already told you, I like both the third and fourth view, the polemic view and the decreation view, because the decreation view is a direct attack on Ma'at, the whole Egyptian concept. And it shows that not only Ra and any other Egyptian deity and the pharaoh, they are not in charge of the order of earth. They're not in charge of the order of the cosmos. They're not in charge of anything. Okay. You know, the one who maintains this order, and he is going to demonstrate that he is the one who maintains this order by destroying it. Okay. By undermining it, by reversing it, to demonstrate that he alone, the God of Israel, namely Yahweh, the one that Pharaoh said, who's this guy? Okay. That is the one deity who is in control and who is master of all these things. So that decreation emphasis, that attack on Ma'at, just generally, and we're going to see it, you know, work out in the first plague and other plagues as well, but just generally, it is decreation, and it's also a pretty effective polemic, you know, against the gods of Egypt. But anyway, Hoffmeyer sort of, you know, summarizes this, you know, his view that this is basically the general point. I want to read you what he says in his Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary essay. He writes, "The cumulative effect of the plagues on the Egyptian view of cosmic order and the king's role in maintaining it is a major issue in the plagues. From Dynasty 4 onward," okay, that's the Old Kingdom era, the Pyramid Age, all right? "From Dynasty 4 onward, the pharaoh bore the title Son of Ra. As such, he was the god of the Egyptian state and was responsible to maintain the cosmic order, Ma'at, on earth, that had been established by Ra at creation. Because of the bond that existed between the created order and the king as the incarnate son of Ra," of course, he's also the incarnate Horus, "he was responsible for the fertility of the land as well as for the proper function of the Nile. And because of the strong bond between the sun god Ra and the king, he was the one who illuminated the two lands." In other words, the upper and lower Egypt, all of Egypt. "The vitality of the land was ensured by a number of annual festivals and related rituals over which the king presided. The nine plagues certainly showed that a cosmic struggle was in progress, and they challenged the king's ability to maintain that cosmic order. If the king failed to execute his duties properly, the land would suffer." In other words, it would be in a state of chaos. The Egyptian term for that is Yisfet, which is how Egyptian literature describes the first and second intermediate periods. When a strong king appeared and regained the control of the land, Ma'at was reestablished. Now, it's the end of the first part of the quotation. Hoffmeyer is going to go on, and he quotes from the prophecy of Nefertiti to illustrate Egyptian theology on this point. So I want to read you that excerpt. He's quoting from ancient Egyptian literature, which is an anthology of Egyptian texts here. And this portion of the prophecy of Nefertiti reads as follows: "Dry is the river of Egypt. One crosses the water on foot. One seeks water for ships to sail on, its course having turned into shoreland. The land is bowed down in distress owing to these feeders, the Asiatics, who roam the land. Foes have risen in the east. Asiatics have come down to Egypt. Ra will withdraw from mankind, though he will rise at his hour. One will not know when noon has come. No one will discern his shadow. No face will be dazzled by seeing him. Then a king will come from the south, Ameni, the justified, his name. Then order, Ma'at, will return to its seat, while chaos, Yisfet, is driven away." That's Ancient Egyptian Literature, Volume 1. And Volume 1 of that series, by the way, is Old Kingdom. You know, and so right away you're going to read that, Asiatics. Well, didn't Mike say the Asiatic? That was the Egyptian term, you know, for Semitic people. Yeah, it was. So we have a reference to the sun darkening. We have a reference to the Nile drying up. You know, we've got the land in general distress. You know, those are two elements that again, sound like the plagues. But this takes us back to, you know, a little bit. I mean, this is Old Kingdom stuff, so it's pretty old in Volume 1. You know, it takes us back to that chronological disconnect, too. There are things in Egyptian literature that sound, you know, like the Exodus plagues. But if you want to know why there's a chronological disconnect, I'm not going to go back into that, you know, quagmire. You can listen to the earlier episodes on Exodus as we just were starting, you know, the series to know what the issues there are. You know, Hoffmeyer concludes his selection then after quoting the prophecy of Nefertiti with this. He says, "The plagues of Exodus 7 through 10 would have been understood by Pharaoh and the Egyptians as a direct assault on the king, who was responsible for the proper function of the Nile, the crops, and the sun. This could be why the unnamed Pharaoh of the Exodus is so angered by the signs and wonders. They were beyond the limits of his control. Perhaps his continued obstinacy was due to his hoping he could somehow reestablish himself as the Lord of Ma'at. That's end of Hofmeyr, but obviously that ain't going to happen. So again, you know, the decreation view I think has real value. I think it serves as a polemic just generally, but we still have, I still like the third view, the polemic as well, because there are some clear shots aimed directly at specific Egyptian deities. So we're going to transition now into the first plague. Again, I like both views, 3 and 4. To me, they work nicely together. So let's make a few observations about the first plague in Exodus 7, 14 through 25. That's the Nile turned to blood. So let me just read the five of those verses, verses 20 through 25 again. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded. In the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, he lifted up the staff and struck the water in the Nile. And all the water in the Nile turned into blood. And the fish in the Nile died, and the Nile stank, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. There was blood throughout all the land of Egypt, but the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not take even this to heart. And all the Egyptians dug along the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. 7 full days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. So that's the last 5 verses of the chapter. Now the setting, let's just talk about that a little bit. The setting of this confrontation is pretty ironic. It's ironic that Moses meets Pharaoh along the bank of the Nile. It harkens back to Pharaoh's decree after the midwives episode that, quote, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile. That was Exodus 2:22. The Nile was, of course, the place where Moses had been placed in the basket as a baby, Exodus 2:3. So just by virtue of the setting, things have come full circle. Again, there's a lot of irony here. You know, we could also note how the Egyptian magicians, yeah, they do the same thing. They turn the water to blood. But you realize, again, in light of what we've talked about as far as the, especially the decreation view, they show by doing that they don't have the power to restore Ma'at either. You know, Pharaoh's the one who's expected to be able to do this, certainly not his magicians, you know, his handymen, his you know, priestly henchmen, or whatever you want to call these guys. So they make the problem worse. They actually, you know, undermine in a peripheral way Pharaoh's own status. I mean, he's the one who's supposed to be able to reverse this. Oh, yeah, we'll help you out. Here, we'll make it worse. he can't do anything. So, again, there's a lot of irony in that as well. And there's a lot of theological polemic there, too. So, let's talk about the decreation assault, the assault on Ma'at thing, and the polemic with the first plague more specifically. Now, the Nile's annual flooding, again, was referred to as the inundation in academic literature. That was actually deified. That was the inundation itself was like a deity concept or a deity sort of thing or figure. Currid notes, quote, the Nile's inundation was deified and personified as the Egyptian god Hapi. That's H-A-P-I. In fact, as early as the pyramid texts, the Egyptians called the Nile River by the divine name Hapi. They often portrayed the god as a bearded man with female breasts and a hanging stomach, probably to show pregnancy, all of which reflect the concept of fertility. Okay? And indeed, Egyptian writings spoke of Hapi as the one who kept Egypt alive. The Hymn to the Nile, for example, taught that life in Egypt came from the Nile. Quote, O all men who uphold the Aeneid, that's a group of deities, fear ye the majesty which his son, the All-Lord, has made by making verdant the two banks. So it is, verdant art thou. So it is, verdant art thou. So it is, O Nile, verdant art thou, who makest man and cattle to live. Verdant is just another term for life-giving. Okay, so this is a hymn to the Nile. Again, that, you know, in Egyptian theology, all life comes from the Nile. So it's bad news. if the Nile is polluted. And Hapi, again, the personified deity figure, the deification of the inundation of the Nile. And when the Nile floods, the inundation, you realize what happens. The Nile floods, it overflows its banks, and that deposits rich soil on either side of the Nile. That's why things can grow. And this isn't like just a few yards. This is miles of soil. This is how Egyptian people eat. They can't grow their crops in sand and in the desert. They depend on the annual regular inundation of the Nile to survive. And again, they refer to the inundation as the deity Hapi. Well, Hapi is not either not doing the job, or Hapi is weak. Okay, he or she, again, it's a, sort of a hybrid figure, is weak, you know, when compared next to the God of Israel. The God of Israel has mastered Hapi. You know, it's the God of Israel, you know, the God of the Hebrews that Pharaoh will not recognize, who actually controls the Nile. Again, it's a theological lesson and a pretty frightening one, and a pretty one that would make the Egyptians angry, and especially Pharaoh. I mean, probably frighten the, you know, most of the populace. But Pharaoh, again, he knows what everyone else in the room is thinking. Everyone else in the country is thinking. You're the son of Ra. You are the maintainer of Maat. Do something about it. And he can't. He just can't. I mean, it's a public humiliation. It's a public display, not only of Pharaoh, again, perceived as a deity incarnate, not only of Pharaoh's fecklessness, but also Hapi's. And this is how the plagues are going to work. You know, you're going to have decreation elements, and you know, that are going to serve as a general you know, attack on Maat, which is by definition an attack on Pharaoh and his status and his power, his divinity. Okay, but you're also going to have individual plagues take, you know, belittle, you know, make small and show to be weak specific Egyptian deities. So I think both of these things are in play. And to end our episode here, Kurd summarizes it this way. This disaster, again, it's just starting with the first plague, this disaster was a demonstration that the true sustenance came only from the hand of Yahweh and not from a false pagan deity of the Egyptians. You know, it's a threat to Egyptian religion generally, because if this condition, you know, persists, and, you know, the other plagues are going to sort of back up the same point, might the Egyptians be thinking, well, maybe we should worship Yahweh because he's the one that keeps us alive anyway? I mean, this is what's at stake. So you have all of this going on, again, in the backdrop of the Egyptian mind. And the Hebrews, you know, the Hebrews are well aware of this stuff. They've been in Egypt a long time. You know, they sort of know the drill. I'm not going to say they're experts in Egyptian theology, but they kind of know the drill. They kind of know what Egyptians think and how they think about Pharaoh and all that sort of stuff. So what we'll do next time, and again, you know, we'll process the rest of the plagues in the same manner as polemic and as, again, this anti-Ma'at decreation sort of idea. Exodus 10, you know, has the rest of the plagues. I don't know if we can hit them all in one episode or not, but probably, you know, a couple episodes, who knows? But this is how we're going to do it. We're going to go through each of the plagues and talk about how they reinforce both of these approaches to what's going on.
All right, Mike, we appreciate it. I want to remind everybody, please, if you haven't done so, go rate or leave us a review on iTunes. We appreciate everybody that has so far. All right, Mike, well, we look forward to the rest of the plagues as the Egyptians did. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Like a Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.